This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the domestic use of military force, the iron fist behind the velvet glove, part one. November 3rd, 2006. Washington Post staff writers Ellen Nakashima and Spencer Hsu reveal the United States for the past 10 years has not only been screening all who enter and leave the country, but has maintained terrorism watch lists and has created a risk profile that is to be stored for 40 years. The federal government disclosed the details of Secure Flight, its border security program that screens all who enters and leave the United States and creates a terrorism risk profile of each individual and retaining the information for up to 40 years. It revealed it in a little-known publication, the Federal Register. The Federal Register, a document published each day with federal notifications of impending changes and asking for public comment, but it is not something, it is not a newspaper, a daily newspaper, a nationally known newspaper that you or I would read. It opened a window on the government's broad and often controversial data collection effort, wrote Nakashima and Hsu, that is directed at both American and foreign travelers. And this was implemented after September 11, 2001. The information, however, became even more ominous because it was later revealed that for the past 10 years, the government has not only been screening people, but has been creating profiles. Long known to scrutinize air travelers, the Department of Homeland Security was seeking to apply new technology to perform checks on all people who enter not only by airplane, but by automobile and on foot. It's called the Automated Targeting System, ATS. And specifically, with respect to airplane travel, it's called Secure Flight. Actually, there are 309 million land and sea border crossings, 87 million air border crossings each year, and 23 million U.S. citizens who cross the border to Mexico or Canada about 130 million times a year. We are talking about many opportunities for looking at the travel, the individual personal data of American citizens. The government has been compiling this massive amount of information. The Treasury Enforcement Communications System, the Advanced Passenger Information System, monitors travelers, passengers' names, records lots of data, including your address, your payment data, your credit card information, your itinerary, and the other people who are traveling with you. This is all analyzed by secret criteria and rules that are unknown to the public. The TECS has 5.3 billion records already amassed, and it is accessed 766 million times a day. This is statistics that was compiled by the National Research Council of the National Academies. This is unknown to each and every one of us. We are all potential enemies of the capitalist state power. Ralph.
Well, Maya, the described process, as Ellen Nakashima lays it out in the Washington Post on December 2nd, is really a part of a larger process that we have been identifying and documenting on Taking Aim for going on for 6 years now. In particular, for example, every time you make a purchase, as we documented in prior shows, every time you buy anything with a credit card, they now are monitoring every particular of your background, including your health records, every time you make a purchase now in a store. Every time you use a credit card for travel, travel is only one facet of it. It is, in essence, the architecture not just of the fascist state, but of the totalitarian state. How come we've never heard about it before? Barry Steinhardt, director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project, asked plaintively. And David Sobel, senior counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, stated, "This program has been in existence without notice for an unspecified amount of time." In other words, the formal declarations about these processes and these identifications and these attempts to have a database on everybody in the United States with respect to almost anything that they do has been in process under the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency and all of this apparatus of the ruling class's enforcement arm to preserve its class rule. This has been integral to this system for decades and even beyond that. Jason P. Ahern, a Customs and Border Protection Assistant Commissioner, stated that the agency is entering data for all border crosses in the ATS database. The data includes name, date of birth, and flight itineraries and credit card information as you were laying out. It includes customs inspectors' interview notes on every traveler. Travelers are screened on the assumptions that they will, that, as Ahern stated it, they cannot and will not disclose. When you look up these risk factors as they are arbitrarily defined, it kicks out people as a target for follow-up. They are targeted and they are followed up. Government officials, the Washington Post continues, have created a vast database on citizens who are law-abiding, as they describe it. 309 million land and sea border crossings, 87 million air border crossings, 95% for entirely lawful reasons, all subject to this process.
And Ralph, aside from your ticket number, your seat number, the date your ticket was issued, the number of bags you're carrying, your bag tag number, your address, all your payment information, your contact telephone numbers, your frequent flyer information, the travel agency you used, the status of your passenger, your identifier if you had a free ticket, if you had a one-way ticket, your email address. In addition to this, the government is also accessing other government files, for instance, your Social Security information and any other information that has been collected, including financial information. In other words, the automated targeting system is connecting up with other federal avenues of information and assigning a terrorist risk factor, of which you have no access. The Department of Justice, the federal government, says that this program assigning a risk profile is outside the Privacy Act of 1974. The Privacy Act allowed the government to collect and distribute information. However, you had a right to privacy. But they're saying that they are exempt from the Privacy Act of 1974.
Well, Maya, this is a subject matter that's elaborated upon in a follow-up article by Michael Sniffen of the Associated Press and published in the San Francisco Chronicle on December 1st. Without their knowledge, millions of Americans and foreigners crossing U.S. borders have been assigned scores generated by U.S. government computers rating the risk that travelers are terrorists or criminals. Travelers are not allowed to see or challenge these risk assessments. The government will keep them on file for 40 years, as you had indicated. The use of this program of travelers was only disclosed this month. But in fact, this has been going on, as the article now spells out, for many decades. A few civil liberties lawyers who had even heard of this, and even some law enforcement officers, said they had been given to understand that this was only being used to screen cargo. And the Homeland Security Department, as Sniffen points out, calls the program the most advanced targeting system in the world, and it is one of total information, no aspect of one's life, health records, every sexual encounter. They monitor your reports on your life history, your sexual history, wherever they find a conversation on a telephone, they enter this into the file. It is a profile, everything but the but your iris identification, which is also in process.
Ralph, new passports have biometric information, and the plans of the government for what is called a pass card, P-A-S-S card, for people who cross the border daily, who aren't using a U.S. passport, in other words, crossing, for instance, from Canada to the U.S. or back and forth from Mexico, they'd be issued this biometric card, a pass card. And so your iris information, your facial features are all part of that, and now have been incorporated along with fingerprints into the currently released passports. The ACLU, however, did respond to the notification in the Federal Register. And December 2nd, another article by Ellen Nakashima in the Washington Post states, ACLU urges the United States to stop collection of traveler data. And Barry Steinhardt, director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project, stated, "How come we never heard about it before? The fact that they've been doing it for 10 years, under what authority?" Just as you said, Ralph, they have not come upon any authority, any legislation that would enable the government to be collecting this private data. And most importantly, to assigning each and every traveler a risk assessment of which you have no understanding on what basis it was created, of which you have no revelation of what your assessment is, and of which you have no opportunity to contest it, whether or not there is true or false information in the compilation of this risk assessment.
Because, Maya, the claim that they are interested in terrorists or in criminals is actually a lie. They're not interested in anything that could be called terrorist or criminal. They attach the label terrorist or criminal to anyone and everybody. What they're interested in is the entire population of the United States. What they're concerned about is the alienation of vast sectors of the population, as this ruling class is driven by the degeneration of the capitalist system to a dependence on military rule, addiction to arms production, the need for permanent war, whether it's the permanent war that Bush and his colleagues pursue or that his father pursues, whether they use special forces and execution squads combined with the blockading of countries that starves out the population, or whether they go for direct occupation and for the subjugation of the entire population through direct force of troops on the ground. Right now, the Privatization Act for all of Iraqi oil in the hands of the major oil corporations combines the Democratic Party and Republican Party perspectives for Iraq. And the point about this is not to go far afield from what we're discussing here, but to show the context. And here you have, in this understanding of what the context is, David Sobel, the lawyer at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who has spelled it out rather clearly. This is the most invasive system ever deployed in terms of the numbers of people affected in the United States. We're talking about virtually the entire population of the United States, not a few million or tens of millions, but hundreds of millions of our citizens. We are 300 million people in this society, all of whom are subject to this. Homeland Security is the rubric, but indeed the data mining project known as Secure Flight, which had caused a furor 2 years ago in Congress, is the little beginning of what we are describing here. And the government notice makes clear that all of this information about individuals are shared with state, local, and foreign governments. It affects all hiring decisions, granting licenses, security clearances, contracts, even for private property purchases, all benefits. The data is furthermore shared with courts, police departments, Congress, and even private contractors. Everybody can see it, but you cannot. Stephen Yale Lohr, an immigration lawyer who teaches at Cornell Law School, stated in an interview. So the magnitude of this is this is the prelude to what we call martial law and the architecture of the fascist state.
Ralph,
this is the totalitarianization of the normal daily life in the daily activity of every citizen of this country. It is indeed the mailed fist behind the velvet glove.
Ralph, let's look at three other examples of the degradation of civil liberties in the United States. These are very recent examples. And also, let's look at these examples before we go into the history of martial law, that is, the iron fist behind the velvet glove. And one that comes to mind is the crackdown on peaceful protest and dissent. President Bush signed the Animal Enterprise and Terrorism Act. Now, this is this happened in November.
Of 2006.
The Senate passed a bill.
H.R. 4239.
In September, the Senate had passed a bill by unanimous consent. And then a similar bill, H.R., as you say, 4239, was approved by the House of Representatives in November. And then President Bush signed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Now, in the mid-1990s, there was also the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. But what the current change to the legislation has done is to make peaceful protest and dissent an act of terror, because any activity on the part of animal rights activists that causes economic damage is considered an act of terrorism. And we had in at the beginning of the fall, six members of the Stop Huntington Life Sciences Animal Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty Committee were convicted of inciting violence as an act of terror when they had protested the Huntington Life Sciences Animal Testing Laboratory in New Jersey. Convicted of inciting violence.
Well, there are a number of aspects to this, Maya, that have to be emphasized. It's, of course, an attack on the right to civil disobedience, and not merely civil disobedience, but legal protest. But the fact that they are targeting animal rights activists is not merely an arbitrary example. Animal rights activists are decrying the slaughter and the unspeakable torment of other species. And indeed, it is the unspeakable torment of other species and the absence of any remote interest in their well-being or any concern about the unimaginable suffering that goes with dismembering creatures who are sentient creatures with feelings and with consciousness while they are alive, stripping their skin off. We've done a series on this. When people are outraged about this and try to protest it, they are the signal targets. And it is not arbitrary that their concerns illustrate what we do to ourselves as we torment every other living creature on the planet. An endemic crackdown on peaceful protest is how it's been described. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act makes all peaceful protesters criminals, terrorists. The bill expands criminal prohibitions, and indeed it targets anyone who attempts to protest injustice. And the Animal Rights Terrorism Act is an entree into attacking the rights of any of us who protest about any aspect of arbitrary rule in the United States. The more crimes that become terrorism, the more people you can label as terrorists and treat in the same way. Every time a piece of legislation like this becomes law, it consolidates the totalitarian state.
Ralph, you have to look at the depth of this. And the depth is not these people are not hurting people. They are not targeting individuals. What the government has now said is that if you disrupt economic activity, you can be considered a terrorist.
Look, Greg Palast, who is basically a liberal journalist, was targeted by Homeland Security and charged with the unauthorized filming of a critical national security structure. What was that? An Exxon oil refinery that was available to anyone with an internet connection and a on Google. Palast was charged under the Patriot Act, legislation. Section 802 is specifically aimed at U.S. citizens and announces that any crime is domestic terrorism, and as such, people can be reinvented as enemy combatants. And here is the point of convergence between the Military Commissions Act, which strips immigrants and aliens of habeas corpus rights, but now we see how the Military Commissions Act, as we had indicated on prior shows, is not merely aimed at enemy aliens, as they are called, or immigrants for that matter, but that's just the beginning of extending this to all citizens who protest peacefully and who find themselves in conflict with the rulers of the United States and want to challenge policies and assume they have the right to speak, the right to publish, the right to have meetings, the right to have demonstrations, the right to have a life in the United States short of bending the knee as passive victims of a totalitarian state.
Well, that leads directly, Ralph, into the next piece of news, the next information reflecting upon degradation of civil liberties here in the United States. And that was a short piece that appeared on the New York Times Online, November 21st, referring to an event that had taken place the day before in federal district court in New Jersey. And that is a second man charged, federal district court in Manhattan, but reflecting upon activities that took place in New Jersey. A New Jersey man has been charged, the New York Times stated, with conspiring to help the terrorist group Hezbollah, I'm quoting from the New York Times, by allowing people to obtain satellite broadcasts of a Hezbollah television station. Salah Elawal, 53, of Mattawan, New Jersey, was charged in an 11-count indictment, unsealed in federal district court. The indictment also charged Javed Iqbal of Staten Island, who was first arrested August 23rd. The indictment charges the men with helping people receive broadcasts of Al-Manar, which features programming that promotes Hezbollah's positions. And what was the indictment? It was for providing material support to a terrorist, an international terrorist organization.
Now, what's significant about this is the New York Times short article actually has to acknowledge Mr. Iqbal was simply exercising his right of free speech. And what people don't seem to be aware of is that here is Salah Halwal and Mr. Iqbal, who are doing nothing more than broadcasting what Hezbollah has on a large and established television station in Beirut. But Hezbollah is a mass movement of the population. They just recently mobilized nearly 1.5 million people in Beirut. And they were, by the way, the population that mobilized under the banner of Hezbollah and other large political and religious organizations in Lebanon included large sections of the Christian population of Lebanon, who were joined with Hezbollah in their opposition to this puppet pro-Western government in the United States in Lebanon. And so this mass station, this station that reflects literally the majority of the population of Lebanon and is a station that is a news station. By the way, one of the important things to point out is that both Salah Halwal and Iqbal are broadcasters of Christian evangelism. And by the way, Christian evangelism and Christian broadcasting is included on Al-Manar. But and the most significant thing about this is the Yahoo News pointed out in its article on two individuals arrested for supporting Hezbollah, is that what they are being charged with is having received compensation. After all, they made a contract with Menar. Menar contracted them, as they would with any bourgeois or NBC or anybody else, to take feeds from Menar so that they have an audience in the United States. And they have a small annual contract fee for these services. And what's interesting about this is that because they were taking payment for their contract, they have been charged with having a material aid to terrorism relationship. But what's important about this, and this is extremely interesting, Hezbollah, the United States authorities are saying, is labeled a terrorist organization. But the labeling of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization only occurred after these gentlemen had been broadcasting with Amanar. The labeling of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, and that's, of course, as absurd and arbitrary as it can be, because Hezbollah is not a terrorist organization. This is a reflection of the fact that he who resists the United States rule, he who resists the Zionist occupation and assault on Lebanon, is labeled a terrorist. But Hezbollah was not categorized as a terrorist organization during the period and during the time frame that these guys were, in fact, making their contractual relationship with Al-Manar. They received not a penny. And it's a small enough amount that they get annually for this normal contractual service. No money was passed to them by Al-Manar in an open contract at a time when Hezbollah was labeled terrorist.
That is right, Ralph. According to an article that appeared in the New York Sun, Hezbollah TV network made payments to City Man prosecutors charge. Yet the Sun had to admit, Joseph Goldstein, writing for The Sun on November 21st, had to admit, quote, the terrorist designation came 1 week after the last check from Al-Manar for $27,973 was wired to HDTV. According to the indictment, the federal government even admits that. The indictment charges for both Mr. Iqbal and Elawal with material support for terrorism, and both face maximum prison terms of 110 years if convicted. And we have to stress, Hezbollah is not a terrorist organization. It's a liberation movement. It was only started as a consortium of various groups at the time of the Israeli occupation. It was the resistance movement in southern Lebanon to the 18-year Israeli occupation, successful in getting Israel out of Lebanon. Now, Mr. Elawal is a dentist in Brooklyn. He emigrated from Egypt 25 years ago. These are both U.S. occupants, citizens, and residents here in the greater New York area, longtime residents. They are being accused of providing material support for terrorism for making accessible information. And it's like banning books, banning newspapers. The federal government is now restricting what we can read, what we can see.
Maya, the Sun article, Goldstein's piece, acknowledges the following. The indictment offers a glimpse of a business relationship between Al-Manar and HDTV. But HDTV's owner, Jabal Iqbal, broadcasts sermons by Christian evangelists. Huh? So his business partner, Salah Al-Awal, who is called a go-between for Al-Manar, he's involved as well in the broadcasting of Christian evangelists. They have a business interest in the interest in Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a mass movement. Hezbollah has a cultural and religious dimension. Hezbollah has a national identity. Hezbollah is a like Al Jazeera. It broadcasts news from all over the Middle East. And so you would have, CNN could have had an interest in broadcasting. CNN has been broadcast many Al Jazeera reports and been paid for the service as well. What this is the criminalization of dissent. 110 years the government is seeking to impose upon these two men for transmitting a broadcast of an established television station with a wide audience globally that happens to be located in Beirut.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Domestic Use of Military Force, The Iron Fist Behind the Velvet Glove, Part 1. We are all potential enemies of the capitalist state power, and this is no more revealed than by Frank Morales, October 29th, 2006, his article, Bush Moves Towards Martial Law. As Frank Morales, who has been exposing for many years the federalization of the criminal police apparatus in the United States, as he exposes here secretly because there was little information about this taking place, he calls it a stealth maneuver. In a stealth maneuver, President Bush has signed into law a provision which, according to Senator Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, will actually encourage the president to declare federal martial law. It does so by revising the Insurrection Act, a set of laws that limits the president's ability to deploy troops within the United States. The Insurrection Act, which is USC 331-335, has historically, along with Posse Comitatus Act, which is USC 1385, helped to enforce strict prohibitions on military involvement in domestic law enforcement. With one cloak swipe of his pen, Morales writes, Bush is seeking to undo those prohibitions. And how did this take place? Public Law 109-364, or called the John Warner Defense Authorization Act of 2007, H.R. 5122, was signed by President Bush October 17, 2006, in a private Oval Office ceremony. And it allows the president to declare a, quote, public emergency, end quote, and station troops anywhere in the United States and take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of the state governor or local authorities. And the president can do so once he states that, once he designates that he is doing so to, quote, suppress public disorder. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the description of martial law and the preparations thereof, which really are not something new. And I mean, Frank has done an extraordinary job over an extended period of time. We're close friends and collaborators with Frank Morales. I have to say that we had done a series of this beginning in 2001 called Police State America. We've done a four-part series on martial law in the United States. And I think the essential thing that I want to emphasize in mentioning that is that the roots of this are not merely in the current activity and the current laws and in the attempts to criminalize dissent and to declare national emergency whenever there is any suggestion of mass opposition to arbitrary rule, but that this has been done all through American history. And this derives from the FEMA operations of Oliver North, the Federal Emergency Military Administration, which is where they were openly prepared to incarcerate 400,000 people in detention camps who were supposedly people who were supporting opposition to the U.S. war against Nicaragua and in El Salvador. And it's not only Rex 84, but it's the plans for martial law that extend to the Northern Command as being placed in charge of civil activity in the United States in the end of Posse Comitatus.
Ralph, that is the creation of the Northern Command that happened recently.
Yes. And so for example, in the CRS report for Congress that was prepared by Harold Relier, the specialist in American national government for the Congressional Research Service.
Right. Ralph, let me interrupt you a second. CRS is the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress.
Right.
Government agency.
And this piece is called Martial Law and National Emergency. It's a summary piece. It talks about 400 dormant legal provisions for the establishment of martial law in the United States. It is parallel to the important article that Frank has written.
500, Ralph.
But I would just mention this, because the title of Frank's article is Bush Moves Towards Martial Law. And that's true enough. But the essential point that I would like to make with respect to that is that it ain't Bush, brothers and sisters. Bush is but the little continuation of these processes and these plans and these, which really go back to the origins of the American Revolution itself, as we will document in a short space of time. Bush is the little continuation. This is a ruling class process. Indeed, Robert Perry, in his article, Bob Gates and Locking You Up Forever. What this article does of Robert Perry's in Consortium News on December 1st of 2006 is to bring together what we've been describing with respect to the surveillance of travelers, with respect to the designation of people who simply broadcast, Beirut stations broadcast, who are faced with 110 years imprisonment, who are now being subsumed under the enemy combatant laws, who are now being subjected to the provisions of the Military Commissions Act, which strips them of habeas corpus and which hands them over to the prospect of military tribunals, which indeed deprives us of even the right to disclose that we've been charged. Defense Secretary Robert Gates will be in charge of a new star chamber legal system that will lock up indefinitely unlawful enemy combatants and any person accused of aiding them. Both those are in quotations. Both enemy law, unlawful enemy combatants and any person accused of aiding them. And we have to be clear that this new Secretary of Defense, who has been celebrated by the Republicans and Democrats alike, former CIA Director Robert Gates, who is being praised by the Democrats for his, quote, intelligence experience and down-to-earth style. Gates was, in fact, the CIA Director and deeply involved in what are called euphemistically the national security scandals of the 1980s, i.e. the criminalization of stealing money and trading arms for narcotics and the Iran-Contra scandal. Indeed, in his memoir, From the Shadows, Gates reveals that the reason that the inquiry about his hand in the October Surprise, you remember, brothers and sisters, the October Surprise is when James Baker and George Bush Sr. Gates and these people were involved with Khomeini in Paris in order to get, to secure the...
And Casey.
And William Casey to maintain the continued imprisonment of or holding of the hostages in the American embassy so that the election of Reagan would be secured because Carter would be losing support as a consequence. Now, in his memoir, From the Shadows, Robert Gates reveals why the inquiries into this were cut short. Senator David Boren, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and a leader of the Democratic Party, shepherded him through the process. Quote, David took it as a personal challenge to cut off the investigations and get me confirmed. Boren's chief of staff, who limited the investigation of October Surprise and of the crimes associated with Iran-Contra, and furthermore with the physical liquidation of some of the operatives who were involved in these things, Robert Gates in charge of that, who was involved in Democratic Party, David Barnes, chief of staff, George Tenet, who then was he was closely associated with President George H.W. Bush, then president, and a decade later, George W. Bush maintained Tenet as his Central Intelligence Agency director right through 9/11, brothers and sisters. Please note what we're dealing with here. From Robert Gates to David Boren to the concealment of Iran-Contra through the collaboration of the Congress, of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, of the Democratic Party, with the crimes of the October surprise and of the Iran-Contra operations, Gates' involvement in these contacts, which involved the father and the brother of Osama bin Laden, who were with them on the airplane, who were later killed in airplane crashes. In fact, the very plane that had carried Bush to Paris with respect to the October surprise. I'm trying to bring this together, brothers and sisters. David Boren promised that Iran Gate allegations against Gates would never see the light of day. Indeed, there was a further dimension to this, because Robert Gates then had meetings with a key Israeli intelligence officer who was indeed able to link Gates to the 1980 Iran hostage scandal and the Iran Gate operations. Who do you think that was, brothers and sisters? It was Ari Ben-Menashe, who has since done a total expose of these operations in two books. Now, we've cited those books on Taking Aim. What we're describing here is the collusion of all elements of this ruling class. It's not just George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan or William Casey or Robert Gates. It's the security operatives for Jimmy Carter. It's David Boren of the Democratic Party. It's Zbigniew Brzezinski. They're all up to their eyeballs in these things, and they are the collaborators now in this entire process with Gates in charge, as Robert Parry documents in his piece, locking you up forever. It's the ruling class, brothers and sisters. It's not the Bushmen.
Ralph, let's return to martial law and the concept of national emergency. As in the CRS report for Congress, they quote the constitutional scholar Edwin S. Corwin. And what's important about what Corwin's quote is that when you speak about martial law, you don't have to be talking only about the total abrogation of civilian authority. That is rule by a military commander. That is when the ordinary courts and the ordinary civil administration is superseded by the will of a military commander. What Corwin says is it's not so definitive. And it is particularly in the history of the United States, there's a line that gets crossed. It's not, as he says, a hard and fast one. It's not a hard and fast law. Because what he says, that military rule rests ultimately, this is a quote, on the will of the President of the United States in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief. And that the employment of the military arm in the enforcement of civil law does not always involve martial law in the strict sense, but that it is still rule by the military, with the commander-in-chief as the ultimate commander, the ultimate say. And what you have here with the usurpation of power, with the current Defense Authorization Act and reforming with the strike of the pen, the Insurrection Act of 1807. And remember, this Defense Authorization Act, the Warner Bill, was a funding bill for the military. And what you have here is that with the stroke of the pen, the president has made it easier to take control of the National Guard, that is to federalize the domestic militia, for what he says, what he designates as a tie to, quote, rebellion. That is, in circumstances that include, quote, a terrorist attack or incident or other condition in any state or possession of the United States that the president determines that state authorities cannot, quote, maintain public order because of, quote, domestic violence. And this is, some believe, in reaction to the fact that the Louisiana governor refused to accede control to the federal government at the time of the Katrina hurricane. And eventually, the federal government did send in federal troops that took control. Ralph.
Well, Maya, once again, the roots of military rule in the United States and the preparations for martial law, as Frank and we have pointed out, and we've documented this over years, even before we were broadcasting on Taking Aim, have to do with FEMA, they have to do with Rex 84. And I'm going to make the follow-up comment on the Robert Parry piece because it is directly related to the question of martial law. Look, in December 1984, a memo was written to CIA Director William Casey recommending the bombing of military targets throughout Nicaragua. And indeed, the recommendations were conjoined to the preparations to lock up people in the United States who would object to this. That's the genesis of the FEMA and Rex 84 that is the prelude to martial law in the United States. There was a 1993 report to Lee Hamilton. This is Lee Hamilton, who is the Democratic Party's figure in the House Armed Services Committee, the very Lee Hamilton who colluded with Baker in the entrapment of Saddam Hussein for the first Gulf War. Who do you think these guys were working with? The executive assistant to CIA Director Stansfield Turner was indeed Robert Gates. Now, Stansfield Turner was Jimmy Carter's man. These people are in collusion together. The Homeland Security contracts for vast new detention camps, the $385 million contract for Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown Root to build detention facilities for, quote, an emergency influx of immigrants. They're talking about jail and arbitrary detention and concentration camps of, quote, 400,000 people. This is the little continuation of what we were talking about with respect to Rex 84. The National Security Decision Directive 188 in 1985 of Reagan, which is part of what is called the COG or the continuity of government. The jailing of 14 million people ultimately in camps in the United States, which were described in a series of newspapers at that time. The description in the Miami Herald on July 5, 1987 of an executive order for continuity of government, which was drafted in 1982 by the FEMA director, Louis Giuffrida. All of these things, the martial law portions of the plan that the John Brinkerhoff, Giuffrida deputy, laid out. Peter Dale Scott refers to these things. Everybody's been writing about this since Rex 84 and since the 1980s. But the point is that what Peter does is to confine this to the Republican Party. Got nothing to do with the Republican Party as such. It's the two parties. It's the one big property party with two names. All of their principal figures are involved in this. It bridges presidencies. It bridges heads of central intelligence agencies. It bridges Clinton. It bridges Bush Sr. It bridges George Bush, W. Bush.
Ralph, this goes back to the times of George Washington, and that's what we are going to discuss in part two, is the use of federal and also state troops to suppress rebellion, to suppress dissent throughout the history of the United States. An important article that you might want to look at prior to next week's show appeared on smirkingchimp.com, and it's an article by Colonel Daniel Smith, Usurpation of Power, the 2007 Defense Authorization Act and the Reform of the Insurrection Act of 1807. Colonel Dan Smith, retired, a senior fellow on military affairs for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. He's a retired Vietnam veteran, West Point graduate, and is opposed to the war in Iraq. And he details the use of martial law. He gives a few of the instances, but most importantly, he starts with the Whiskey Rebellion of 1791.
1794, actually, Maya.
The Whiskey Rebellion of 1791. Anyway.
Well, let's look at this here, Maya.
Okay. We have two different dates. We better look and learn our history.
In 1791, Maya, in order to raise revenue to help pay the Revolutionary War debts, the federal government assumed from the states a tariff on the sale of distilled spirits. Now, this tax was not a major burden for the large conglomerate distillers in 1791, but the smaller operators, that is to say the artisans and the small farmers who made some money by whiskey stills in their backyards, and which was a widespread activity of the small artisan farmers who were the backbone of the revolution, they were devastated by this. It was indeed Mead intended to wipe them out and to consolidate control over the whiskey trade into the hands of the conglomerates. And as a consequence of the 1791 Act, there was a rebellion in 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794. And as this, I mean, I think this is one of the most interesting and instructive articles by Colonel Daniel Smith, Usurpation of Power, the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, and the reform of the Insurrection Act of 1807. What this does is to demonstrate that from the day of George Washington, the Constitution of the United States was designed to protect the property rights of the few. It was to protect the privileged from mass insurrection, from mass mobilization, from the exercise of popular will, from rebellion, revolution, and, for that matter, political activism and independent political struggles of the population that had made the revolution in the United States. And indeed, under the Whiskey Rebellion that arose from this attempt to wipe out the small distillers and concentrate the whiskey trade in the hands of the large wealthy manufacturers, if you like, gave rise to a generalized uprising across the what was then called the frontier, western Pennsylvania. And it's there that George Washington, and we will go into this in great detail, it's there that George Washington called for military rule, for martial law, for the abrogation of all civil liberties and rights in the United States, in the new Revolutionary Republic. The Whiskey Rebellion, here is the irony and the paradox of that. They declared that the right to protest was did not include rebellion or insurrection, and that habeas corpus could be suspended. And by rebellion and insurrection, they meant mass mobilization. They meant withholding of services. They meant civil disobedience. They meant generalized protest. And they are, and we're going to detail this in the next segment here, but two things that have to be said. The roots of martial law go back to the founding of the Republic. The roots of martial law lie in the criminalization of dissent. You'll notice that habeas corpus in the American Constitution is to be suspended in the event of insurrection or rebellion. And insurrection and the rebellion is very broadly defined, and at the time of 1794, the uprising by the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, George Washington invoked the right to suspend all, to start, not have merely military rule, but to mobilize the military and national guards to subjugate the population. The spread of the Whiskey Rebellion, ironically enough, is what made the rulers from George Washington on, but particularly at the time of George Washington, they had to concede to the Whiskey Rebellion the first 10 amendments to the American Constitution, what we call the Bill of Rights, is the result of the struggle of the mass in 1791 to 1794. What we call the protections that are being violated by George Bush, what we call the abrogation of the constitutional privileges and protections such as habeas corpus, were the very things that the Bill of Rights was conceded by the rulers to prevent that rebellion from spreading across these United States. The ruling class and the property-owning class from the inception of American history, this bourgeois revolution, from its inception sought to consolidate its control and saw as its enemy the mass of our people. At every conjuncture where we have organized, they have confronted us with arbitrary rule. That will be the next segment, part two. Brothers and sisters, please mobilize on December 9th, Maya, go ahead, for Lynn Stewart.
Lynn Stewart, Saturday, December 9th. Let's unite for the struggle ahead, an ode to joy and struggle. Join Lynn Stewart and the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee, thanking you for all your support over the last 4 years, and also commemorating Mumia Abu-Jamal's 25 years in prison. At the Judson Memorial Church, 55 Washington Square South, in New York, December 9th from 6:30 on. Speakers, music, and more. Food and drink provided. provided. For more information, go to www.lynnstewart.org. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Domestic Use of Military Force, The Iron Fist Behind the Velvet Glove, Part 1, was recorded December 4th, 2006. It will be available on our website. Note our new URL, our new website address, www.takingaimradio.com. We are all potential enemies of the capitalist state power. Please organize. Resist. We will be with you next week.
From the Revolution of 1794 to Lynn Stewart and Mumia Abu-Jamal, the struggle continues.